Welcome everybody. And we have some new people, some not so new people. So this is what we call an informal talk. We don't do any chants or anything. And it's a study class. I'm going to be giving a series of talks on a particular text that we often chant. And it's actually a very important text in our particular tradition, which I'll unpack for you in just a few minutes here. But before we read it, I'd just like to kind of give a little bit of an introduction, and then we'll read it together, and then I'll start talking about the actual text itself. When I sat down to think about what to say, one thing that came to me, which often comes to me when I think about our practice, is how often people come to practice because of unhappiness, and maybe even desperately unhappy with our life as it is. Or maybe we're not unhappy, but still there's some kind of a niggling thought or feeling, or maybe even an intuition that there must be something more, something we're not quite getting as we go through our daily life. And I think most of us do experience some intimations of what that is. Maybe while listening to music or hiking in the woods, or drifting along in a boat, engage in some kind of repetitive activity, like knitting, maybe, or sometimes in meditation. There's a line in one of our chants that reads, Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. And truly, the gates to a larger vision of our lives are everywhere. We have all experienced moments when fear and critical thoughts just drop away, leaving a clear sense of spaciousness and openness. Fear from, or free from craving or wanting this moment to somehow be different than it is. At those times, our life seems somehow a little more luminous. But then we can get caught in a sticky trap. We have the idea that the real juice of our life, our real life, the importance of our life, is somehow out there. Somehow we need to kind of slough off the vexations of our everyday life to really get a hold of that mystical something that's out there. And we may even come to think that our job and daily activities are necessary only so that we can find the resources to engage in the really more truly fulfilling activities, whatever those might be, like stamp collecting or hiking or music or sitting on the cushion. In other words, our happiness and contentment is separate from our everyday life. And we begin to see our practice as a bridge from the grind of our everyday life to some kind of tranquil sea that we can dip a toe in now and again over there. And this is not an unusual view, really. I think it's really the kind of message of our time. You know, we work hard now so we can play later, right? We put up with our life so that we can all go down to Mexico for a week or two. And then we can be happy. But this attitude keeps us from casting our gaze down at our very feet and realizing that we are already home. Our habitual view can keep us from opening to the spaciousness of this moment. While washing dishes, repairing the bicycle, sorting the recycling, making breakfast. Now, really, this sense of more or less like two distinct realities, right? The one that I want and the one I'm stuck in, is not really not just a symptom of modern times. Sherto Shichuan, one of our Zen ancestors, our Chinese Zen ancestors, who lived in the 8th century, wrote a poem to help his contemporaries and us see or accept perhaps a truer view of reality, a more inclusive and, I think, helpful view. Now, some of you new to Zen practice, some of these names will go, whew, and that's fine. But let me just give a tiny little bit of background about Sherto. So again, remember, he lived in the 8th century. He was a very famous Zen teacher. And he studied with one of the most famous Zen teachers of all in Chinese history, Huineng, the sixth patriarch, as he's sometimes known as. And yet, after this study, he seemed to have lived a really quiet life, teaching a few monks in a small, unknown province in China. However, his writings have been most influential. And among his writings, he left us a poem. In Japanese, it's called Sandokai. Or in our translation, it's called The Harmony of Difference and Equality. And for us, it's one of the main chants and one of the key teachings, carefully studied from generation to generation to generation up to the present day. It is said, this poem, to be the foundational teaching, actually, of this particular school of Zen, the Soto school. And the reason it's so valued is because it addresses the lopsided view of reality that so many of us live our lives by. So, before I go on, maybe we should chant or read it together once. So, this is on page
8.
So, harmony of difference and equality. So we'll just kind of read it in a normal voice, and we'll just kind of read it through together. Okay, so please join in. The mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. While human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. The spiritual source shines clear in the light. The branching streams flow on in the dark. Grasping at things is surely delusion. According with sameness is still not enlightenment. All the objects of the senses interact and yet do not. Interacting brings involvement, otherwise each keeps its own place. Sights vary in quality and form. Sounds differ as pleasing or harsh. Refined and common speech come together in the dark. Murky phrases are distinguished in the light. The four elements return to their natures, just as a child turns to its mother. Fire heats, wind moves, water wets, earth is solid. Eye and sights, ear and sounds, nose and smells, tongue and tastes. Thus, with each and everything, depending on these roots, the leaves spread forth. Trunk and branches share the essence. Revered and common, each has its speech. In the light, there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark, there is light, but don't see it as light. Light and dark are opposite one another, like the front and back foot in walking. Each of the myriad things has its merit, expressed according to function and place. Phenomena exist, box and lid fit, principle responds, arrow points meet. Hearing the words, understand the meaning. Don't set up standards of your own. If you don't understand the way right before you, how will you know the path as you walk? Progress is not a matter of far or near. But if you are confused, mountains and rivers block your way. I respectfully urge you who study the mystery, do not pass your days and nights in vain. Now, thank you. Was that pretty clear? It's one of these kind of dense teaching poems that were composed throughout various periods in Zen history. A lot of Chinese cultural aspects and views also kind of massaged into the poem, so we'll unpack it slowly over the next few weeks. Today I'll probably just end up talking about the first three or four verses and the title. You know, it's the Zen tradition that you, when you have like, you'd have like a big study retreat, you know, that goes on for 3 or 4 months. This is in the old days, right? Don't do it anymore. But you usually spend the first week on the title. Every day, you know, you come and the teacher's there giving teachings about the title. So I won't do that. But I do want to say a couple of words about the title, because it kind of frames, I think, the poem for us. And I'll use the Japanese pronunciation, even though it's a Chinese text. And the Japanese pronunciation is, as I mentioned earlier, Sandokai. Three characters, there's three Chinese characters that compose the Sandokai. San literally means three. But it's kind of a metaphor or represents plurality, many. Right, many, many things. And do is the word for unity or oneness. So many and oneness. Many and oneness. And kai means, I guess, somehow like to meet or to agree with, to come up to a tally of numbers. So san, the many and the oneness coming together, agreeing with each other. And the title, I think, is expressing that the many and oneness, despite our common understanding of what those terms mean, are in complete agreement. It's the way reality is. Many and one, both at the same time. In this book, Branching Streams Flow in the Darkness, a series of talks given by Shinryu Suzuki, one of the first Zen teachers in America, and our great-grandfather, we're connected to him. He wrote very charmingly that kai actually means like a handshake. Unity and the manyness of reality are kind of clasped together or merge just as two hands are clasped together in a handshake. And what might that be? What made it be like to live our lives with this understanding? Holding the paradox of diversity, him, her, mine, yours. That paradox of diversity and unity, all at the same moment. With that same sense of intimacy that a mother would have with her child. It's not my food and child's food, it's just food, you know. I eat the baby's food, baby eats my food, there's no hesitation. There's no strong sense of division. How could we let go of our strong sense of separateness? If we could do that, how would we shape our lives? Let's turn back to the poem for a few minutes and consider at least the first four lines. So it goes, the mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted from west to east. Now, of course, the great sage of India is Buddha, right? But the word mind in Chinese includes our kind of typical Western idea of mind as kind of cognition or thinking, and it also includes our emotional being. In fact, sometimes it's translated as heart-mind, and I think we could say it signifies a spirit in the broadest sense of the word. We say, you know, our spirit, meaning not in a Christian sense, but just in this huge sense, this, a poetic sense of who we are. Something larger than just our thinking mind, and maybe even larger than our emotional life, our heart. In this case, perhaps we consider mind as representing the profound understanding that the Buddha had, the clear vision of ultimate reality. Or another way, perhaps, of saying it, Buddha nature, our ultimate nature. And this Buddha nature, this understanding, is intimately, completely transmitted or given from west to east. Now, in one sense, this means, of course, from India into China, because that's where Shirto was. He was Chinese. But Shirto means the vast sweep of east to west, of west to east, as a metaphor of everywhere. The insight of the Buddha is everywhere, mysteriously flowing through the entire East and West, and nowhere left out. Nowhere left out. So in our tradition we use the word Buddha nature, but you could use all kinds of other words, whichever is meaningful for you. Divine, God, mysterious oneness, wholeness. But in this line, he says, nowhere left out. So what does he mean, nowhere left out? He goes on, well, human faculties are sharp or dull. The way has no northern or southern ancestors. I love this line. Now, part of it refers to a bit of history of Zen, and so it may be a little bit hard to understand at first. But very briefly, in the early Zen schools, they came to be divided into what they called the North Schools and the South Schools. And each had a bit of pride at being a little bit better or a little bit truer than the other, right? You know, kind of competition just naturally seems to rise. But here, Shirto cautions us against all comparisons. While human faculties are sharp or dull, the way has no northern or southern ancestors. Now, isn't it true we all want to be sharp? We want to be smart, right? Anyone here not want to be smart? Like, we want to be smart. And perhaps assuming that intelligence will help us in some way perhaps get the Buddha Dharma or to kind of, you know, get out of our sticky situation or you know, get a deep understanding. But Shirto is telling us here, yeah, some of us are smarter. Some of us have real powerful memories or can grasp complicated concepts really quickly, and some of us are slower. I think I'm kind of a little more in the slower camp. Some of us are not so brainy or interested in philosophical understanding. But our sharpness or dullness has nothing to do with the way. What is the way? The way is our Buddha nature. It has nothing to do with our Buddha nature. Our Buddha nature is not in a book. It's not a philosophical insight or even a religious experience. It's not separate from who we are at this moment. Our dividing our lives and practice into good and not so good, or this is boring, or you know, this is what I need to do to get there, is really just a diversion from Sherto's poem. It's an illusion. He's saying everyone practices and lives the way. We are the way. How could there be any comparisons? So, cautioning us not to see the way as outside us, as something we can compare, Sherto challenges us even a little bit further to push our understanding to the limits. And that's in the next two lines. So far, okay, is this making a little bit of sense? Good. The spiritual source shines clear in the light. The branching streams flow on in the dark. Now this sentence is quite simple, yet it's really paradoxical. In fact, Sherto here is asking us to turn around our usual understanding of things. But again, we need to unpack it a little bit to get to understand some of the metaphors. So, the spiritual source shines, boy, that's hard to say. The spiritual source shines clear in the light. In light, we become aware of the myriad things. We become aware of the Chinese say of the 10,000 things, right? We see them, all they surround us. Differences stand out, right? Big nose, small nose, ears that stick out, ears that are flat, red hair, blonde hair, black hair, tall, short, thin. All those differences stand out. So light here is a kind of metaphor for separateness. We see the separateness of things. Of course, this is our kind of everyday experience. In the dark, distinctions disappear. So dark becomes a metaphor for unity or for oneness. Yet, what's really strange or interesting, in this line, Sherto proclaims that unity, or the kind of spiritual source of things, shines in distinctions. It shines in the light. In the very distinctions that we are surrounded with, there is the unity. In the bright light of day, we see the diversity of the world. All seem separate. My cell phone, not yours. Your shoes are dirtying my clean carpet. Right? Yet, if we open our eyes and our minds a bit wider, we can see perhaps a grand unity. What seems at first to stand alone is really flowing within an endless ecology. Kind of like Lovelock's Gaia understanding. You familiar with Lovelock and Gaia? That the whole world is alive. This is a living organism. That what we see as bits and pieces flow as part of an endless whole, like a river. Branching streams flow on in the dark. The next line, right? And during this time of year, on a moonless night, when I stand outside on our back porch, I hear the night sounds of wind, insects, frogs. And these sounds merge into the sense of night, into the dark itself. One other metaphor may be the experience of listening to the many instruments that make up a really large symphony. We hear the symphony, right? But it's really hard, like, what violin is playing? And, you know, we just hear the symphony. It's many, and yet their experience of this is a unity of sound. You know, perhaps this sense of unity and diversity as being together is most clearly seen in the things that are alive. Life shines in diversity. Frogs, birds, trees, babies. And diversity expresses the play of life. Does that make sense? A little sense of that? I teach at SFU, and I end up with this, like this, people, like, I go, does it make sense? And eventually they get it, and they, of course, many of them are busy doing this. Yeah. Life shines in diversity, and diversity expresses the play of life. So this is the beginning of the poem. And in some ways, he's trying to shake us from our habitual view of separateness, and that somehow we need to get to a place of unity. But he's saying, that's not it. They're both here, now. They're both true, now. It's not one or the other. Not that one's bad, one's good. They're both, this is the way reality is. And it doesn't depend on us being smart or dull. There's just the way. Entering, embracing, living the way. And in the next few weeks, I'll unpack a little bit more, which I think will become a little bit, hopefully, a little more clear. So now, what I'd like to do is to spend a few moments for us to have a chance to talk in little groups a little bit about this. And you can be honest with each other. So what the heck was he talking about? So what I'd like to do, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. Okay, good. So let's get you just kind of clump in groups of three. And that should work out. I'll give each person will have like about 2.5-3 minutes. I'll time you. And how we do it is this. One person speaks, and you have the full 3 minutes. Just say what you want to say, and if you finish speaking at that point, you just sit in silence together. The other two people just listen. It's just really kind of a careful listening practice. And then when I'll ring the bell, the next person will begin, and they can say what they'd like to say. And then when you're finished, just there's no crosstalk. And you don't need to refer to what someone else has said unless it's connected to what you want to say. And then afterwards, the other little thing I just need to quickly mention is we ask you not to bring it up again, like say, oh, no, you brought that point you mentioned earlier, I wanted to tell you about. Don't do that. just, unless that person brings it up, it just stays and ends within this little circle. So it gives us a sense of safety. We can, you know, say what we'd like to say, and then it just ends here. But we say it carefully, and we listen carefully. Does that make sense? Okay. So what I'd like you to do, or to think about, you can talk, you can say almost anything you really want to, but I usually like to give a question. And the question I'd like you to think about a little bit is, we've just talked about these first few lines. How might these lines kind of apply to your life? How might they help you open your life further?